Hey guys, how's it going? Welcome to Drunk Movie Rants, a podcast where we talk about movies. My name is Alonzo O'Leary, also known as Lons, and I will be your host for the duration of this podcast. Every episode, we will feature a new guest speaker where we talk about different film topics and movie genres and things that we like or don't like about the world of cinema. The first episode of the season features a conversation between myself and two close friends of mine who are both avid lovers of cinema. The first is my good friend Josh Nicholson. Josh and I were stationed at Fort Benning together for basic training and officer candidate school for the U.S. Army. My second friend is one of my lifelong friends, Evan Gilchrist. Evan and I went to junior high and high school together in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, and we also worked in film together in Los Angeles after both of us graduated film school. In this episode, we tackle the role of the director and the influence that they hold over the creation and overall vision of a film. We also discuss some of our favorite directors, and we pose the question of what is an auteur, where we discuss all the different elements of the auteur theory in film history and cinema, and how it has evolved over the years. If you like what you hear in this episode, feel free to check out our website, where we list all of the different topics and films and directors that we discuss in each episode. Thanks, and enjoy. All right, here we are, the beginning. We are at the beginning now, Josh. Okay. It's all downhill from here, as Steven
Soderbergh says. It's like I'm on the rabbit hole of going in deep on film shit, like just film nerd geekiness.
It's meant to be a bridge. I think you were the one that used the term a bridge. Like, one of the things that I think frustrates me the most about a lot of film-centered podcasts is if you didn't go to fucking film school and, like, learned all of that, like, super in-depth nerdy shit, you're not going to get, like, even 5% of what these guys are talking about, let alone care, you know? So I'm just like, nah, this is going to be one of my best bud Yuri was like, so it's Barstool Sports, but for movies. I was like, yeah. And then I looked up Barstool Sports on Instagram. I was like, this is in line with what I've been imagining. So I think whenever I talk to people about movies, it's either one or two things, right? If it's not genre or type of stories in movies that people like to see, it's directors. And like, directors are like the all-star athletes of the film industry. So I was like, you know what? Fuck it. Yeah. Episode one, we're going to talk about directors. Yeah. Okay. So do you want to kind of brief the audience on the research and homework I gave you before?
So you gave me a task of looking into auteur, and I hope I'm saying that right, but I think it's French for author.
Yeah. Auteur is like how most people say it, but you're good.
Okay. Say it again. Auteur.
Auteur, like auteur. Yeah.
Okay. Auteur. Okay. So auteur. Oh, auteur. Man, I'm really struggling. but basically, auteur is a tool to analyze film in a way that you look at, let's say, the director, and I think that's really the focus of auteur here. You look at the director and you say, okay, this guy has a certain line of work, and has the same themes, same tone, same elements, same, you know, style, and you can kind of line that up and find similarities between that. And mm-hmm. So if you see sort of a progression of his quality and art by still adhering to that kind of familiarization between all of their films, they sort of become an auteur. So examples of an auteur, from my understanding, would be like a Quentin Tarantino, right? Of smash of genres, revenge film, you know, very exciting, you know, good scripts. We talked about Nolan in our last episode. Mm-hmm. He has the themes of time, and that's one that like always is woven throughout there. He has a very particular way of editing and also like the way that he films. Like, here's an example, right? Like, he always does close-ups with like that really good blurry bokeh effect in the back, and he's always, you know, so those were really
very telephoto lenses. And
it's very like signature, and so you can start putting these little characteristics per director that kind of builds their portfolio of their auteurness, and that's kind of the way that I'm understanding that. And I've got a lot of thoughts on this, because, and I like to, you know, ask you about it, because you know you're way down the rabbit hole on on everything. So I'm curious to see where kind of you stack up.
So I didn't really get that in depth on the auteur theory until obviously I got to film school, but it was one of those things where I think it was sophomore year. Yeah. Sophomore year, I took film history, and you go through all the way from the silent era all the way to modern contemporary filmmaking, like 90s, early 2000s. We kind of stopped around the 70s or the 80s, but we would watch clips from contemporary films in conjunction with older films. And they posited this idea of that if a director is of a certain level of sophistication and skill, there will be a certain level of recurring things that come up in their films because they're so inherent in that director's artistic and cinematic vision.
Oh, right.
And they will constantly be shining through whether or not the director means for it to happen or not. And like I always say that with the auteur theory, like you can watch a single scene or see a single frame or hear like two lines of dialogue and you'll know almost automatically, like that's that director's film. You know what I mean? Or that's like you said, like a Tarantino film, like that's a fucking QT movie. You're watching something on TV. That's a Christopher Nolan movie. And it's been around for a really long time. Like I think as early as the silent era, that was something that would, and I mean, the French didn't really go deep into that. I think it was until the 60s or 70s. I'd have to look it up. It's been a while. But what becomes really interesting is like you have these conflicting beliefs among critics and other filmmakers of like, is the auteur theory really relevant? Is it a crock of shit? Like, should we give these guys that much power and that much importance in their role? And I just think anybody who's watching films for the first time or like taking that initial step into like learning more about movies and like wanting to know more about it, like knowing about directors and the auteur theory is a big thing because. I mean, I am a personal believer and follower of the auteur theory. I think it's real. Like, yes, it does take a team of people and it's a giant collaborative effort to make a film. But at the end of the day, like the director is the person that has to steer the ship. So like they're the one that's going to determine where the ship goes and what the ship does, you know? And I think that again, like among the heavy hitters, like the badass filmmakers of different generations, like you see it. Like one of my favorite directors of all time still is Akira Kurosawa. Like to me, he is like the Michael Jordan of fucking filmmaking. Mm-hmm. And you could watch one scene from it where I'll be on fucking Instagram scrolling and I'll see a frame and I'm like, that's probably a Kurosawa joint. And I haven't even seen all of his movies yet because there's so many. And like 9 times out of 10, I'm like, oh, yep, I was right. It also becomes a really great way to categorize and like helps people kind of, because with streaming apps nowadays and the endless plethora of access to films that people have, like it's so hard to narrow down, like, where do I start? You know, and it's usually, again, like I said, either genre or directors that kind of is that starting point.
Right, right. So you think there's some validity then to the auteur theory?
And I mean, I agree. I do. Yeah, yeah,
I do. Yeah. I'd have to agree with you. You know, the director is the captain of the boat. They know where it's going. And you brought up a point earlier, you know, as everything is getting filtered, right? You have the clothing department, you have the artwork guys, you have the editing, you know, the story, the script, everything's going to get funneled right through the director. And then all of a sudden, you know, their, what's a great word for that? I guess their perspective on life is going to get shot right through that filter. And, you know, one of those is, you know, Steven Spielberg. He always has
100%.
Like, a dad in there. You know, there's always that, like, you know, the dad sort of complex in a lot of his movies. You've got, and it could be anything, like, you know, Tarantino's got the revenge stuff. You know, I want to bring this one up, and maybe I'm bringing it up too soon. Michael Bay has a peculiar
like,
style of auteur.
Well,
it's not necessarily like the themes. It's also like the way he edits and the way that, you know, he styles everything.
Yeah.
And so that plays into it.
Yeah.
I've got a couple questions I want to ask you about as I've been studying auteur. And I know you've got a comment here, but I want to agree too that I think that the auteur has validity.
Yeah.
But on either end of the spectrum, whether you say it doesn't exist or it does exist, I think it's somewhere in the middle.
Yes.
Definitely somewhere in the middle. But it does give the director a lot of power. So
yes. So then this is where the auteur theory gets muddled because, I mean, a good director should have a signature vision, right? So like any guy worth his salt who's going to pick up a camera and make a film like, in my opinion, like, yeah, their vision should shine through. But like, would I say Scorsese is an auteur? Absolutely. Again, another heavy hitter. Would I call Michael Bay an auteur? Not necessarily. Like, do I know it's a Michael Bay film when I see it? Yeah. If we're starting like base level auteur theory, yeah. But at the end of the day, like, does Michael Bay have anything really higher or deeper to say in most of his movies? Hell no.
Okay, so absolutely I looked into this. Not. Can we jump in Michael Bay for a minute?
Of course we can. Of course. So
let's start at like the baseline of what a maybe a weak entry level director into an auteur theory is, and then we can like move all the way up to know Kurosawa. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I was thinking about Michael Bay, and out of all the movies I've seen, let's just say the Transformer trilogy or is it a trilogy. I don't even know.
No, saga. There's like smashing. Five. There are like five of those movies at this point.
And I've seen a handful of them. And I honestly, it's like all the same movie to me.
Yeah.
Like I can't remember anything specific about each movie.
No.
And I guess what I want to get at is, even though I can't remember the details of any specific movie, I know that they all had a very particular style.
Yes. You
know? There were fast edits. The script was pretty bland. There's always some young guy who's like going against the grain and sort of a rebel. There's the cute girl. There's even a lot of like pro-military stuff in there.
Oh my gosh, that's in all of his films.
I want to say that I've heard that even the military has helped fund some of these movies to put those things in. I think I've heard that.
Yeah.
He has a lot of simple political stuff in there. You know, of course the like I was saying earlier, like the fast editing and all that, but he doesn't have anything to say, is what I'm getting at. Like there's a style that I think is an auteur. Now, the more I kept reading about Michael Bay and I was studying this, he says and he claims that he has a message he wants to send people, and he won't say what it is. People have asked him. I like was listening to some of his interviews, and they're like, "Hey, Mr. Bay, like, can you tell us what like Transformers means to you, like in your heart? Like, what is this as an art?" And he's like, "It's for you to figure out." It's just like,
oh my gosh.
Okay, you know. And so I'm kind of thinking,
whatever.
There probably isn't anything. You know, maybe when you boil down all of his style, maybe there's something underneath that. Maybe he actually is pro-military. Maybe he really likes pretty young girls. Like, I don't know. But what does that mean to me? Nothing really.
Yeah.
You know, but there's at least something coming out of that.
Yeah.
And as far as like the auteur theory goes, like you said, you know, you see a little bit of Michael Bay in all of his films, you know, it's him. And I agree. I think he's 100%. A weak candidate to be a part of the auteur selection.
Yeah. It's funny you bring up like, what does he have to say? And I've shown you this YouTube channel, but like I always tell people, like one of the best dissections of Michael Bay is the YouTube channel Every Frame a Painting by Tony Zhu, and he does this great beat by beat breakdown of Bay's style and what makes his film so signature to him. And it's funny because it breaks it down as like it's a lot of flashy shit ramped up and cut really crazily, made to look really cool. But does it have anything really meaningful to say? arguable. Very arguable, you know?
Yeah, is it really art at that point?
Yeah, exactly.
Not really.
Yeah.
So, I would say he's kind of on the lower end. But who then is like on the next tier? Or maybe is it like, are you like kind of in and then in? Or is there like a spectrum?
I mean, it's like, dude, it's like I always say, or I've never said this before. This is an interesting I always say it's like a big bubble, right? So once you enter into the auteur bubble, things get interesting because there are guys that are closer to the center of the bubble and there are guys that are more on the outskirts of the bubble. Like, in my opinion, fucking Michael Bay is one of those guys on the outskirts, you know? Like, you can tell visually that it's a Michael Bay movie, but does his film have anything deeper to say?
Yeah.
Not really. You know, he makes fast food. He makes the fast food of movies. Yeah. And like you'll have other directors that are in there that might have a signature type of shot or their films explore very similar types of themes, but they may not have any real specific visual style. Right. So like, for example, a director who like could be argued as an auteur, but I don't necessarily agree is Sam Mendes. So he directed American Beauty, Jarhead, Road to Perdition. And then more recently he did Skyfall, Spectre, and then he did 1917.
That's right.
Like 2 years ago. And like you would never connect those movies ever in a million years.
This is a great example.
To the same man. And if you listen to his director's commentaries, like there are similar themes that he tackles and similar things that he cares about as a director that he puts into his films, but it's hard for me to find a through line across his work that really connects his stuff. Like, to me, Roger Deakins comes closer to being an auteur, and he's a cinematographer. He's not even a fucking director. And he comes closer to me to being an auteur than Sam Mendes does. No offense, Sam Mendes. Love your work. I think you're an excellent director. If for by some goddamn miracle you end up listening to this podcast. but I don't know. There's just something about the way Deakins shoots things and the way he composes his shots. And like, whether it's intentional or not, there's like a deeper meaning behind how he lights everything he shoots that I'm like, I know that that's a Deakins shot. And I know that there is some significance. And like, of course, as the cinematographer, he needs to draw from the director to get to where he goes. But like, he's one of those guys where like, sometimes he outshines the directors he's working with. And I'm like, that movie would not be anywhere near as good, in my opinion, if Roger Deakins hadn't shot it.
Right.
And this isn't me trying to like boost up Deakins' ego. I mean, he's got a fan base bigger than fucking, I mean, he's got a fan base just as big as The Rock. You know, it's just most people don't know the people that are obsessed with Roger Deakins. I'm one of them. A fanboy.
who was that gal you were telling me about? The gal back who wrote the critical analysis that like she thought.
Okay, so was Pauline Kael. Yeah. Okay. Yes, so Pauline Kael. another aspect of film culture and cinema, like theory and arts, like is learning about the critics. Cause like, yeah, you got Siskel and Ebert. Like everybody knows who Siskel and Ebert are, or like Ebert and Roper, if you're looking at the 90s, the early 2000s, but like, the critics of the early days between the 40s all the way to like the 70s and 80s, Pauline Kael is like the poster child of like an entire layer of cinema culture that people don't know about, because there was an era in filmmaking where films did really well based solely on the opinions of a few critics, or critics would go to bat for certain films and help them get successful. And then in the fucking between the 60s and the 70s, you had the French New Wave, where a bunch of French film critics were all like, fuck this shit, we're gonna make our own movies because we're sick of people not being able to make the movies we want to see. And you got guys like Jean-Luc Godard and Francois Truffaut, who just took up the mantle and made amazing, like game-changing films. And it was like, that was like the first example of like, those who can't make movies, critique movies, is like, nah, dog, you can fucking analyze movies and be good at making them too. And like that, again, that's a whole other conversation we could have.
Yeah.
But yeah, Pauline Kael was super against the auteur theory. She went, oh my gosh, she was so mean. And I mean, she's mean in a lot of her stuff that she writes, but especially on that essay, I was like, damn, girl. Like,
yeah. So my question then, so Pauline Kael, she was the one who had the criticism about the auteur theory. And I should have wrote it down, and I'll go check out for part two. But so she talks about like, hey, it's pretty boring if you're going into a movie expecting a certain style, tone, feeling from the same director every single time. She's like, if it doesn't shift or change, then what's the point? Is this director going anywhere? Is their art evolving? Are you feeling anything? Mm-hmm. This is pointless to like go in and already be preconditioned to what the movie is going to be. She's like, great. Yeah. You went and saw a thing by a director, but was it any good? Was the movie any good? You know? And so my question to you then is, you were talking about Sam Mendes, right? And how, you wouldn't be able to track his auteur through or theory or auteur factor, I guess, in all of his films.
Yeah.
Does he sort of transcend the auteur theory? Does that make him, does that like help Pauline Kael's theory or her criticism where she's like, hey, Sam Mendes is like, is she still alive today?
Nah, she died in the early 2000s, unfortunately. Right.
So if she was alive today, she might say something like, hey, this guy, Sam Mendes, there's something to this guy. Keep your eye on him.
Yeah. You know? So this is where and when Evan comes on, we'll probably talk about this, but my all-time favorite working auteur director is Paul Thomas Anderson.
Oh, he's amazing.
And like, I mean, everybody knows him because of There Will Be Blood, but he has a whole other plethora of work. And I think to me, he's always been like the gold star for what an auteur director can do, because his films, in my opinion, are such deep and direct artistic extensions of him as a filmmaker.
Yeah.
That, like, you can track his entire progression of his art through his films. And he tackles completely different topics and completely different types of things. But at the end of the day, you can almost feel a very subtle through line. And it's the same thing with Scorsese.
Yeah.
In terms of, like, if you look at the general arc of their film career and watch films that they made in the 70s, or like films that Scorsese made in the 70s are not the same films that he made 2-3 years ago. And it's the same thing with PTA. The films he made in the early 90s are not the same films he's making now. And I mean that in the best way possible, in terms of like, they are examples, in my opinion, of someone who's able to transcend that, because everybody can go see a Michael Bay movie and know exactly what they're going to get. You know what I mean?
Right.
And you know that you're not going to get much more than what you know is there. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And like, you had guys, so like a great director who's long passed away, who I think is like a low key, could be borderline considered an auteur, is Alan Pakula from the 70s and the 80s. He made All the President's Men, which is like regarded as like one of the best political thrillers, also parentheses, one of the best films ever made. And he had a whole track record of making these like very low key thrillers in the 70s, 80s and 90s. And like, he's always gone under the radar, but his films are incredible. And like, you can feel a through line in his movies if you watch them, like of like, oh wow, like this guy was onto something. But
yeah,
it wasn't necessarily a stylistic choice. And that's where I'm like, okay, that could be an example of a guy, like, I may not necessarily like know it immediately, but there's something there. There's something underneath the surface that these directors are able to put into their art, where you can almost feel like, oh shit, like there's something there. And like, it's something that's that is emerging from that person.
Yeah.
That makes sense. You know what I mean?
Like, you feel like, even though you haven't met that person.
Yes.
You know them.
Yeah. Or I know something about them that only the film can communicate. You know what I mean? I mean, we're heading into some real deep shit, but I mean, you were the one that asked that question.
But yeah. And that, I liked Pauline Kael's criticism, where she was like, if these guys are coming up with the same stuff every time, then what's the point? Why go and see the movie again? You can just go back and see the earlier work that might be better.
Yeah.
So I was thinking, if you had known of a director who had high quality films, but none of them really matched up, like, and as again, as you bring up Sam Mendes, you know, I think that that's really an excellent candidate, I think, for somebody who is an auteur, but also, you know, fits into the theory, but also connects with Pauline Kael's criticism.
Absolutely.
And so that sort of puts them up a notch, in my opinion.
100%. I could definitely see that.
You know,
I mean, who are your top two? Give me your like top 2 to 3 guys that you love as directors that you would consider auteurs, even if they're lower level guys, because there's one guy I'm thinking of. That I'm like, I'm pretty sure he's gonna say it.
Man, Tarantino,
of course,
is probably my favorite auteur.
Okay,
personally,
yeah.
And I say that not because I like them as director, but I'm trying to say that as with fitting into the auteur theory.
Got it.
He has a very specific way of scripts and stories.
Yeah.
And then I don't know why I keep like disregarding animated movies in my mind when we talk about this, but Hayao Miyazaki is another one.
Oh yeah, Miyazaki. Out there. Oh my gosh.
I'm going to push Ridley Scott out and put in Hayao Miyazaki as my placeholder for the top 3.
Okay.
Because so if I had to make an argument about why, you know, Miyazaki is an auteur, he has a very specific animated style that's almost childish.
Yeah.
And he has done some mature movies. They're few and far between, you know, like Princess Mononoke is the big one, right? It's PG-13. But all of his other movies have usually a young girl who's the protagonist, is very strong and, you know, strong-willed and sometimes stubborn. Mm-hmm. And she has an adventure, and it's very, you know, fantasy-driven, or, you know, a lot of themes of nature. That's another thing that Miyazaki, like all of his films have, that like there's some 100%. Sort of environmental impact, which I really connect with as well. And you kind of walk away, you're going, oh, that was a great movie. But then you're like, I'm thinking about it, right? Like, oh, well, there was that city, and then there was this thing. And, you know, I mean, Princess Mononoke is a fantastic example of how, he layers in like his fear. Like, and you can see that, like, if I was to talk to him on a personal level, I would say like, hey, how do you feel about like the future of our world right now?
Mm-hmm.
And I guarantee you, he would say, I'm a little concerned environmentally that, you know, we're not taking care of totally. Mother Earth here.
Yeah.
And that to me, I've never met him. I don't know that, but through his film, I can feel that. And he's somebody I would consider an auteur.
Just thinking about Mononoke and Spirited Away too. I just watched Spirited Away for the first time.
Oh, it's beautiful.
Like a few months ago. And I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
I like Mononoke better, but
me too. It's my pinnacle. Mononoke is the best.
The Spirited Away is pretty damn good. And like the American dub of Princess Mononoke, like, okay, so for everybody,
it's great.
Okay, so listeners who are tuning in right now who have never watched animated Japanese animated films, what has been a common tendency in the industry is you'll have the Japanese subtitled version with Japanese actors. And then there tends to be an American dub without subtitles of American actors doing it. And there's like a pretty small group of actors that the Japanese typically use for their dubs.
Right.
Princess Mononoke's American dub in the 90s, they fucking got some heavy fucking hitters. Like Claire Danes voices Princess Mononoke. There's a bunch of huge.
Yeah, you've got what Christian Bale's is Howl. You've got Liam Neeson as Ponyo's dad.
Yeah.
You've got Kate Blanchett as Ponyo's mom.
Yeah. Like all of his films, his brilliant films bring in all these heavy hitter A-list actors to do these dubs. And it's so good. It's fucking incredible. Oh,
right.
So good.
But no, I'm a big Miyazaki guy, and man, yeah, okay, he'd probably be my favorite auteur. Now that we bring this up some more, he's moving up the list here.
No, he's incredible, man. That guy's that huge heavy hitter, big heavy hitter in that category.
And this is what's so fun about the auteur theory is thinking, if you haven't met that person, would you know them? Mm-hmm. And I think that I would personally.
Yeah,
I have a connection.
I definitely think Kurosawa and I would have some good talks if we met in real life. I don't know how Scorsese or PTA would feel about me. I feel like I'd get on their nerves, but man, I would love
to. You got a little too much.
Well, I mean, it would just take a little while, you know, it'd take like a half hour, hour.
Take the starstruck to.
Yeah. Just being like, you are a normal goddamn person who just so happens to be very good at their craft.
It'd be a godlike craft. Yeah.
Yeah. Like I remember the first time I met Guy Ritchie, it took me a minute. I was like, oh. He's like, I think he was the guy that popped my cherry as far as like a director whose films I knew and recognized. And like, you watch the scene and you knew like, oh yeah, it's fucking Guy Ritchie joint. Like freshman year of college, a lot of people's film projects are just them just totally aping the directors they're obsessed with. And everybody talks about it before they even make their movies. So like when you see it, you're like, oh yeah, you're ripping off Fight Club. You know, and guys would be talking about Tarantino and David Fincher, or like, you know, on the more artsy side, Stanley Kubrick. And then you got me in the back corner, like, any of y'all seen Snatch? Like, I'm not talking about like the disgusting sexual term. I mean, have you seen the movie Snatch with Brad Pitt, directed by Guy Ritchie, starring Jason like, no, okay. All right. I'm just gonna go hang out in the back corner. Yeah, it's cool.
Right.
Fuck you, fucking wank, because they don't know the ways of Guy Ritchie. Ugh. They're missing out on life. And then you got people that like try and say that he's a fucking Tarantino ripoff. And I'm like, no, absolutely not. Tarantino doesn't have to be the only guy who corners the market on heavy stylistic stuff and freeze frames and messing with time and jumbled plots. Like other directors can do that too. And also, by the way, there were guys doing it before Tarantino made it cool.
Right.
Just saying.
Yeah.
Oh, it looks like we have a new speaker in our midst. Evan, is that you? Evan Gilchrist, is that you?
How's it going, fellas?
Oh, snap. Evan Gilchrist in the house.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. Josh, can you hear him?
Yeah, you're
loud and clear. I didn't know I was going to jump into a live feed, so
this is
happy
great.
I thought there was going to be a little warm-up, but I'm glad to jump in live.
Yeah, hell yeah, brother. It's just we're just rolling with it, man.
Rock and roll.
Yeah.
Let me get my mic set up.
Here. Well, you came at the nick of time. We're just about to end the podcast. Hey, have a great night, everybody.
Yeah, we're about to turn this off.
Yeah. I think we got everything covered.
Yeah. Okay. So all right, Evan's officially in. So
I'm here.
All right, Evan. So we had a pretty lengthy discussion on auteur theory and auteurs. And Josh, did you want to hit him with Josh brought up an interesting point. So well, first off, we'll start off with an easy one, right? So tell us about some of your favorite auteur directors that you regard on that level.
All right. Well, if we're talking classic auteurs, last night I was watching myself some Kurosawa.
All right, yeah.
I knew, you know, if we're talking the classics, I got to bring up the masters. So,
yeah.
And I know my boy's a Kurosawa fan. So I had to dip in. I watched some Drunken Angel.
It was
my first time seeing that one. I tried watching his first feature,
Sanchiro.
So like, I couldn't, I wasn't feeling it.
It's slow,
like,
man. It's so
it
slow.
It was a little, yeah, I was like, I was craving that later era.
Yeah.
Kurosawa, so I had to switch it up. Yep. But that's no disrespect, you know, meant of course, but it wasn't the vibe. But Drunken Angel really satisfied me, so I'm glad I switched it.
Hell yeah.
But Kurosawa, if I'm just gonna list them off, Kurosawa. I mean, you got the heavy hitters, you know, Bergman.
Yes.
Just the classic heavy hitters, Fellini, Truffaut, yeah. Godard. Truffaut.
Yep, I these talked just, about them earlier. These
are
yeah.
The, yeah, these are just like the obvious ones.
Yeah.
And then, you know, some of my personal favorites are like Andrei Tarkovsky.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a fan of just kind of a random ones too. You know, you don't think of auteurs. Randomly, I've been getting into Preston Sturges.
Oh my gosh, you know? Yeah. Okay, so I'm gonna backtrack for some of our non-film listeners and for Josh. All right, Josh, so important one that we hit, right? Fucking, so in the 60s, there was a whole surge of foreign filmmakers just running train on the industry, man. Like,
yeah.
Just, I mean, in the foreign sector, not in America, but like you had these guys that just were like killing the game and like were true auteurs. And like, you could tell that those were their films. So like you had Ingmar Bergman, who was a Swedish director. He made a lot of experimental heavy dramas. You had fucking Federico Fellini. He's like the godfather of older Italian cinema. He made a lot of really interesting, like surreal type films. A lot of psychological stuff, but his tone was always so playful and like fun. And you could have some heavy shit going on screen. Like a woman is miscarrying while her husband is fucking another woman. And like the scene, it almost feels funny because of the way he directed it. And then you got Tarkovsky. Tarkovsky is the king of like, Tarkovsky didn't give a fuck about plot. That dude like is just like, mm-hmm. I'm going to have people walk around in the rain for an hour. Yep, that's it. They're just going to walk mm-hmm. around in the rain. And maybe, like, I'll cut to some trees. Maybe one of them
He was one of those first guys who latched onto the idea of, you know, what only film can do. You know? I always kind of come back to this, like, there's another guy, Robert Bresson, you know?
Yep.
There's just, like, these certain directors that were trying to break away, I guess, from the traditions of... kind of a theatrical bent, you know, in filmmaking mm-hmm. and trying to be like, all right, what can, you know, what can only films accomplish here?
Yeah. Other than telling stories, like, yeah, we get it.
Other than just narrative, basic yeah. narrative. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, like what, you know, what can it be accomplished unique to this medium? And yeah. Tarkovsky is one of the dudes who's trying to get after that, I think. Yeah.
Like,
but
Josh,
then there's yeah, plenty of earlier dudes. No, go yeah. ahead.
I was going to say, Josh, like the easy modern equivalent that most people get when I bring up Tarkovsky is Terrence Malick, right? Like if you've yeah. seen The Tree of Life or The okay. New World or what's the one he did more recently? I mean, Tree of Life is the big one. Knight of Cups with Christian Bale. Like these super avant-garde films that don't really rely on narrative. And they're just kind of like these expressionistic mm-hmm. poems of image and music and like acting. But
yeah,
you could literally just, there'd be no plot and you'd still get the same, you'd still get the same desired effect out of the film, even if it had no plot. Like, like Malick, in my opinion, is like the closest equivalent to like what guys like Tarkovsky and Bresson were doing back in the day, if that makes sense. This is a perfect place. I'm going to go make my drink and we have to do the drinks of the night. That's all right.
Oh, I'm going to do a little refill then.
Yeah, stand by.
I can't
all
even
right.
believe this, but I haven't even opened mine yet.
Even better. It's going to be warm, sure. but I don't think you'll care. All right. BRB, I'm going to go make my drink. No, it is a kilt lift. We're gonna go over it. Don't worry, boys. We're gonna get there.
Poor Loco.
All right, is everybody back? Do we have everybody back? Okay, so we're gonna take a brief break in our discussion to highlight the drink of the night. Every episode of this podcast, we're gonna do a drink of the night. Somebody's drinking something. We ain't gonna be drunk, but we're gonna be drinking. Okay, so we'll start off with Evan. Evan, what are you drinking over there in Seattle, Washington?
Up here in the great Pacific Northwest, I'm just sipping on a nice little classic whiskey and Coke. Got myself it's actually a whiskey from Colorado, some Rocky Mountain water in here.
Hell yeah. What's the brand? Give us the brand.
It's called Tin Cup. It was on sale and hell it came yeah. with, you know what I'm talking about?
No, but that's just a dope name for a whiskey.
Yeah, it's pretty sick. Like it came with a little tin cup shot glass and that's like that's definitely the reason I bought it.
Fuck yeah.
But it's also a good whiskey and I got some Mexican Coke in here.
Oh, great.
Oh yeah, Josh. This guy doesn't play. This dude. Sorry. This dude does not play around with his beverages and his foods that he drinks. Yeah. Like Evan will send me random pictures at night of like weird craft sodas or foreign drinks that he finds at like bodegas. And he's like, I'm so excited to try this. And it's usually either like, it was fucking fantastic. Or it's like, yeah, probably not going to get that one again. And it's like, it's one or the other. And it's the same thing of like, it'll be like 3 a.m. and I'll get that text of like a half empty bottle. This soda is amazing. You know what I mean? And I'm like, I'll respond tomorrow.
That's cool.
Josh, what are you drinking, baby?
All right. Hey, I'm getting in touch with my roots here. I've got a Kilt Lifter. It's a Scottish ale. And I was in a hurry like last time. And you can buy them in these little, what is this, pints? I don't know what this is.
Evan, he's obsessed with that fucking beer. The first time first time I ever went to Josh's house, that was the only beer he had in his fucking fridge. And I was like, I don't know what
you're drinking in my house.
Yeah, that's it.
Damn, I got to give that a try. Yeah, is that, you can get that anywhere? Or is that
it's just a local brew from a place called Four Peaks here in Tempe, Arizona.
Oh, you're in Arizona. I didn't even know where you were. Okay, you're in Tempe. Cool. Right. All right.
So... it's great. I love it. It's got a great taste. As they put here, malty, toasted, and love. Baked with love.
So baked. It's great. Nice baked beer. Good shit.
We know how like moms and stuff, like it was baked with love.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I really enjoy it. It's definitely partial to it. If I'm not drinking this, I'm drinking any kind of whiskey I can get my hands on.
Yeah, buddy.
No, that looks like a good one there, man. Yeah, I gotta try that out. Gotta get my hands on that.
Yeah, hell yeah. Send me your address. I'll buy you some.
All right, cool.
On me.
All right.
He's obsessed with it, Evan. I'm not kidding.
what do you got there,
tonight, I figured I'd start us off classy. I'm doing Maker's Mark 46. With a nice big fat whiskey. It's beautiful. Just like the fucking, just like the logo, like the fucking marketing. Unfortunately, the people will not see it, but like the fucking logo was based off of these big fucking cubes I got for Christmas. And it's prime real estate, as Evan would say.
Yeah, the the ice cube size matters so much in the shape of it.
Yes.
Like if you have one, can I check? Throw them to the camera real quick. I want to see what you're working with. Okay. Yeah, that's is it a cube?
It's a cube. It's a cube.
Oh my
god.
Yeah, like that cube shape just like adds something to it, man. Yeah, like, I got these normal ass typical ice cube shapes and it just looks a little cheap, you know? Like if you have that big ass rock in there, like it looks fucking cool. Feels nice.
I'll get my Parisha got me these. I'll find out where she got them from. I'll send them to you for your birthday in a few months.
Sounds good.
They're dope as fuck. I didn't realize they were whiskey cubes until like I actually used like the tray, because like I was so pissed off. I was like, really, she got me fucking ice cube trays for Christmas? I mean, she got me other things too, but I was like, really, like fucking ice cube trays? And then I filled up the big square.
That's awesome.
It's just a six pack. It's just literally just six squares, and I filled it up. I'm like, these are fucking whiskey cubes. And I was like, all right, like, or whoever, I don't, maybe it's one of my aunts, but I was like, whoever got these, like, all right, fuck it. Like
delayed.
Perfect gift for you.
Yeah. I was very happy about it. I was like,
is that actually called a whiskey cube?
No, but it just sounds good. I like, cause but
I love the sell here. I love it.
I know.
I'm totally. I'm like, where do I buy one? I'm looking on Amazon right now.
Is it one of those?
I'm not
like
doing whiskey right without these damn ice cubes.
I know, right? Yeah. Is it one of those silicone pop out little deals? Like it's a silicone tray.
Yeah.
Okay, that's nice.
I'll send you, bro. I got you. Come on, I owe you. I owe you a gift. I get you something every year. Josh, did you want to post him some of the questions you hit me with? Your idea that an auteur doesn't necessarily need to be a director thing. I was like, Evan will eat that shit up for breakfast, lunch.
Yeah. Okay. So as we talked about auteurs, we were talking about how they specifically directors and how like the art, and so you've got costume design, you've got script, you've got actors, you've got, you know, the guys building the sets, and everything just gets pushed right into the director and then pushed out into the world, right? And it becomes a film, it becomes a movie. And so Lonzo's bringing up a point about how there's a cinematographer that he really likes that has really good style that almost outcompetes the director. And it kind of triggered something. And I thought,
Roger Deakins, his name is Roger Deakins.
Yeah.
And the idea was basically, can anyone else that's on the assembly line outcompete the director, and or can their auteur of work sort of outshine whatever influence the director might have downstream?
I don't think a true auteur would let that happen.
That's fair.
If a director, if we're talking in like the strictest sense of that term,
yeah,
I feel like anybody who's trying to put their kind of stamp like that is, they're gonna do it by any means necessary. Mm-hmm. And they're definitely, for example, like the classic go-to example would be like Citizen Kane, where he, Orson Welles, put himself on the same card with Greg Tolan because he had such massive respect for the cinematographer Greg Tolan.
Yeah.
And that film would absolutely not look the way it did if it weren't for Greg Tolan. So as much as a director as Orson Welles as he acknowledged, I'd say the same thing with Gordon Willis and Coppola on the Godfather films.
Yeah, totally.
Like Coppola openly acknowledged, there's no way this film would have looked like this if it wasn't for Gordon Willis. So that is the criticism of the auteur theory to me. Like I definitely take issue with it at times because it's not just the director, it is everybody's, it's like a sentence kind of spoken to by a grip in between shots might influence the way like the director, talks to his actor the next scene or something. So it's
totally.
So it's a super collaborative process, and to kind of pin it all on the auteur, we're not writing novels here. Like it's not just like a guy in a person in a room. So I think it's a little misplaced in film. And I think definitely like the collaborative nature of it, kind of adds to a lot of influences coming in. But at the end of the day, like a director will put their stamp on a film if they want to.
I was saying of a certain level of sophistication it takes to be a real auteur. But like there are times, like I've seen films where Roger Deakins shot them and like his cinematography is better than the movie that's being directed.
Did you ever see that movie In Time?
Yeah, you were the one that told me to watch it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That was the first digital feature he shot. And it's just fucking trash, of course.
Yeah,
but
it's
like,
not a good
movie. It kind of is cool that what he shot on Alexa, I'm guessing, at the time whatever.
Yep.
Just think, In Time will be remembered as the first time Deakins used, like when his biography's being written or whatever.
Yep.
It's too bad.
And it's a fucking, it wasn't like Sicario or one of his amazing ones. It's like, it's fucking In Time with Justin
It's
Timberlake.
So cool how Roger Deakins has been able to totally master digital cinematography. You know, it's cool that we kind of learned about film in the time we did because we saw his transition. And I would have totally thought of Roger Deakins as just a film director or a cinematographer.
Yeah.
Like a guy who knows how to master celluloid.
Yeah.
But then all I can think of him now is like the master of the fucking Alexa.
He's the guy who champions digital cinematography. Oh, Josh, do you know anything about film versus digital as far as movies are made? Do you know anything about that whole dispute?
Basically there's been a death of film, like as far as like the production of it, the use of it, movie companies and sort of production companies are like, hey, look, digital is so fast. We don't have to translate anything from film. We don't have to store it. We can just throw it in a hard drive. We've talked about this quite a bit about like photography and stuff, but it has a different texture to it when you do film.
Yeah.
Like Nolan's a really big film guy.
Yes. And Tarantino.
And Tarantino. So, they're still holding on to it, but everybody else is moving on to new mediums and the digital. What was it? Who was one of the first to really pick up digital? Was it Lucas?
Like Soderbergh.
Yeah, Steven Soderbergh was one of the champion guys, but George Lucas was the guy who pretty much paved the way.
Oh, yeah.
With the Star Wars movies. Sure. Yeah.
So, as far as I understand today, really nobody's shooting film anymore. And it's sort of a novelty. And
it's
a
minority. I mean, right. there is still very much a smaller group of people, like, because the issue run into, right? So, like, you have shooting on celluloid versus shooting on digital. And, like, film reacts to light differently than digital does, and film always had a very signature look to it that just carried a certain level of gravitas and like quality that digital couldn't match. And then when the Arri Alexa and the Red One, those are the two big cameras in the industry, when those dropped, there was the first time where you had a digital camera where the sensor and the microchip almost equaled what film was able to do, both lighting wise and like imagery wise. And then you kind of had like split factions of guys who were like, I only shoot film, and guys who were like, I'm going with digital. Like David Fincher, Steven Soderbergh, Roger Deakins, they're all very big on like shooting digital. They love like the things that they can do with it. And then you still got guys like, you know, like Nolan, and Edgar Wright is another one. He's a British director. And of course, Tarantino, who were like, film till I die, baby, celluloid for life, you know what I mean?
Yeah. And then there's a good amount of like kind of independent directors that are embracing Super 16 and able to get their hands on some 16 millimeter film, which I think is like a potential, you know, if there's any kind of thing that's going to keep it alive, it's going to be like younger filmmakers attracted to 16 millimeter trying to do that.
And 60 millimeter, you can tell that's film. Like, there's no digital camera that's going to look like that ever. Like, it's like of a certain quality where it's nice, but it almost looks cheap. But if you shoot it right, you're like, oh, that looks even better than a 35 mil image does. Because a lot of times now, Evan, you talk about this all the time, like 35 mil stills and digital, like Alexa stills look almost exactly the same.
That's the issue that I have. Like, we definitely have talked about that. How it can almost be replicated. I mean, the grain is so fine, and you know, I feel like if you want to get that film look these days and really make it pronounced, like if you're trying to show, hey, I shot this on film, I think you gotta do it Super 16 these days.
Hell yeah! All right, a big request we've been getting from people, especially now that the Instagram is up. So movie requests, right? So like, one of the things on my Instagram page we've been dealing with a lot is people are always asking me for movie recommendations, right? So we're going to go down the line. We'll start with Evan, then Josh, and then me. Like, three movies that you've seen recently that you really dug that you would like throw out for people if they want to check out a good flick. And then that's where we'll start closing remarks.
Does it have to be an auteur or just
good flicks? Nah, man, it can just be anything. Like, at this stage of the game, like, whatever, something that's just really good.
Oh, starting with me. Let me think for a second. I've been watching a lot of older stuff recently. Like, I've been catching up on the Criterions, like the Preston Sturges. They got a bunch of his shit on there. But like more contemporary shit.
And anything. Just
you know what's like a random ass movie? I don't know if I mentioned this to you that I saw like a little bit ago that's like kind of been sticking in my head for whatever reason. Is have you seen the movie Coherence?
No, I've heard of it though.
Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Remember that movie that came out? It was a while ago at this point. That guy Shane Carruth who made that movie
Primer.
What was his first feature called?
It was Primer. So Coherence is the one where they have that party, right? It's like it starts like The Invitation does, but then it gets weird throughout the night because of the comet.
The basic premise of Coherence, I think it's on Hulu. Yeah, it's on Hulu, I'm pretty sure. But the basic premise of it is like, it's like this dinner party among some friends, just casual, nothing kind of an uneventful night. But there's this comet that's passing over and it's just like fucking with time. And they kind of like soon realize that some shit's awry, like there's possibly like some doubles of them that are being created by like some alternate universes or something. But the cool thing about it is that it's like a sci-fi movie with just like no effects, but it's like pretty scary. I thought it was like kind of scary. Like any kind of like doppelganger type shit always freaks me out. Yeah. That's definitely like a freak out spot for me.
Totally.
So like just that like doubling, there's other versions of you out there that you don't know about maybe. It just handled that kind of in a like cool low budget, like non-effects way.
Yeah.
That was pretty creepy. That was something that was pretty cool to me recently that's been sticking with me.
Hell yeah.
I'll try and think of some others as you're talking, Josh.
Yeah, Josh, what do you got, baby? Anything. Yeah, it can be new movie, doesn't matter.
So the ale's kicking in and I thought of a movie and while you were chatting, I was like, I'm going to talk about these three movies. And as you kept talking, I was listening to you. I literally forgot all three movies. So I had to take the effort to pull up my phone and write them down. And I was like, I don't remember. The most random three movies that popped in, the most recent movie I've seen was, I'll recommend this one. They're kind of the same vein, but it's a Kurosawa film. It's Yojimbo. or yes. Oh, Sanjiro.
Yeah.
And we just watched Sanjiro. Just recently. And they, you know, very similar movies, but loved it. If you get out there, go see it. It's on the Criterion Collection, and it's an older flick, black and black and white. We're gonna want to watch it dubbed. I think that's the only way you can watch it on there. Do they have audio selection for?
Dude, we want you know we watched it in Japanese with subtitles.
I'm sorry, not dubbed, guys. So, this thing is kicking in, man. I getting hot over here. Yeah, it's subbed, you know.
You gotta watch the subs. If you're a dub man, fuck you.
No,
with those foreign films, fuck you. Read the fucking subs.
I'm gonna go ahead and take this, and I'm just gonna put it to the side for a little bit because I probably had a little too much.
No, but, man, keep it going.
Yeah, so subbed is the way to go. Yojimbo's great. I would also recommend Princess Mononoke. That's one that we've talked about a lot here. I've seen that movie
for
a million
sure.
times. And
hell yeah.
And I think if you want to see an auteur, as we're talking about, you know, auteurs, that's the one you want to go check out.
I love that you're on Miyazaki, man. I've been thinking about him a lot recently. What's the one you just mentioned?
It's called Porco Rosso, and it's about a pilot who's a man who, through some magic, becomes a pig. And he has
to... I don't even know this.
It is so fun because they just start the movie, and he's a pig, and you just believe it, and you just go forward, and everybody's like, oh, it's the pig guy, and nobody's freaked out that this guy has a face of a pig, you know? And it's got like a World War II sort of Italian vibe. I think it actually might be set in Italy. It's been a while since I've seen the movie, but and it has a lot of the Miyazaki flair where there's pilots and they're flying, and there's, you know, everybody's kind of unified into this. Like, there's a lot of different factions, and there's a lot of romance. And it's a shorter film, but one that I think you'll really enjoy. So, yeah, I recommend Porco Rosso.
Nice.
So that's it. Yeah, there we go. Yojimbo, Princess Mononoke, Porco Rosso.
Hell yeah.
Yeah. I think a good thing to do would be to recommend like what's a good entry point. I don't want to drag this thing on too long, but what's a good entry point for some of those like big directors we've been talking about? Like, what's the like kind of movie that they should jump into if they want to get into Bergman or something?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Like, there definitely is like the accessible film.
Yeah.
And they're by no means like lesser films. They're just like, there's things about them that make them a little more accessible.
Yep.
And I think that's a cool way to get started with like some of these like big name people.
Yeah. They're easier to digest for like the more,
like a contemporary viewer.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Exactly. The more contemporary viewer. That's the perfect way to put it.
Yeah. Like Sinjaro for sure.
Yeah.
Cool. Were you going to say anything, Alonzo?
Oh, man. I mean, I went back into my list of movies I watched recently. So the first one that I watched recently that was a game changer for me, army buddy of mine, he's Korean. He recommended this Korean film called Chingu, which means friend. And he told me he was like, it's like a fucking classic in Korean culture. It's like our Godfather type movie. And I was like, okay. Motherfuckers, this shit is on Amazon Prime for $3.99. I was like, done. And dude, it was so good. Like, Evan, it's like, it reminded me of Once Upon a Time in America, but it's not 4 hours long. And it's just a beautiful, tasteful, like coming of age movie meets like a crime saga type flick. And it's so good. Oh, like it was, I mean, like, the Koreans have really been stepping up their game. I mean, Park Chan-wook and fucking Bong Joon-ho are like the fucking staple of like the Koreans have been hitting hard on cinema for a long time. But this is like an example. It came out in like 2001, I think. And like, this shit is over 20 years old and it's still fucking fire.
Yeah. Dude, who's the director? Is it a guy that's done any other stuff?
He's done a bunch of stuff, but he's not a guy I know because he's not like a poster like a lot of the other guys are. So like now I'm like, I gotta watch some of this dude's other shit. But that film alone, I was like, this is really fucking good.
That's awesome.
So that'd be my first recommendation. A movie that I had been meaning to see for a really long time, part of my O'Leary education as a kid. My Aunt Kathy was always obsessed with the movie called Paid in Full. It's in the same era as like The Boys in the Hood, Menace to Society, like the African-American struggle in the city type coming of age story. And it was the first time I'd finally gotten to see it in its entirety without like seeing like YouTube scenes or like just random quotes that people would tell me. And that was a dope fucking movie. I'd say that's an underrated gem of the genre. I'm like, I can see why like so many people I know love this movie and talk about it so much. And then a director that I don't know if I consider him an auteur, but he only has two films out right now, and I love both of his films dearly. The films of Tom Ford, the fashion designer, or fashion guru, as some people would say. Both of those movies are fucking fantastic, and both of them, I believe, are on Netflix. First film he made was called A Single Man. Colin Firth plays a classy homosexual gentleman in the 60s who's struggling with the loss of his lover. Such a good movie. And then Nocturnal Animals, everybody knows that's my fucking jam from 2016. I will go to bat for that movie any day of the fucking week. Fucking Amy Adams, Jake Gyllenhaal, Michael Shannon. It's like this dope noir / drama film. I couldn't recommend it highly enough. Like, Tom Ford is low-key one of my favorite, like, an amazing director and storyteller. Like it's awesome seeing someone so good at one thing be able to translate that into another art. Like,
so hell yeah. How cool is it that he directed those two movies? Like, that you're right. Like, A Single Man especially is so good.
So,
like, for Tom Ford, you know, a designer to make those. I mean, that movie is excellent. That deserves a rewatch. That's a good recommendation.
Any closing thoughts, boys, as we close out this 3-hour long recording? Obviously it won't be 3 hours in the fucking thing, but any closing thoughts, boys?
Yeah, we've been talking for a while, man. I feel like I still keep going, but I mean, it's good convo. I enjoyed it. Thanks for having me on.
Hell yeah. I mean, you'll be back. I mean, you'll both be back. We're gonna have some recurring guys. Josh, any closing thoughts?
Yeah, I had a really good time. I did some personal study trying to figure out what auteur means, and I'm saying that right now, so I'm feeling special and a part of the team here. But no, this has been really good because it's a filter or a layer or a tool of film that, like, I can now apply moving forward. So, like, I feel more empowered, like, as far as like a viewer and on the audience, and it was also really fun to, like, pick your guys' brain a little bit about what your thoughts were on sort of the limits and the maxima of what the auteur theory means and how it can apply to our modern day. So I really appreciate this conversation. I had a really good time, and I probably had a little bit too much, a little too fast. And but overall, you know, it wouldn't be a drunk movie rant without a little bit of that. So
hell yeah.
Yeah, man. I appreciate your perspective. Yeah. Definitely.
And Evan, it was a pleasure meeting you today as well.
Yeah, for sure, man. Definitely appreciated hearing your thoughts. So.
Fuck yeah, it was awesome. Guys. I'm out of whiskey. My closing thoughts tonight, guys. I'm out of fucking whiskey.
Black Diamond.
Well, boys, it's been a pleasure. Until the next time. Yeah. All right.
Appreciate it.
Good night, fellas.
Good combo.
Later. Later.
For those of you who are still here, thanks for listening. We will be dropping our next episode in mid-April, where we discuss the genre of heist films and the spy and espionage subgenre with my good friend Diane, who I went to college with. The intro and outro music for this podcast was produced by Eric Godlow. Feel free to leave a comment or hit us up on the messages on our Instagram or our webpage @DrunkMovieRants. Thanks.